And we move to the fifth case this morning, which is Anderson versus Benick. Ms. Bowler?
May it please the court. Mr. Anderson has served time on sentences that should have expired. This, in turn, negatively affected Mr. Anderson's current sentences. In other words, Mr. Anderson will have to stay in jail longer than he should be there.
Well, first of all, the question is this just a state claim and not a constitutional claim? But beyond that, what's the practical implication? How much time do you say that he will end up serving that he should not have?
Well, specifically, we're saying both his 1995 sentences, which were 1 year each, should have discharged before he was arrested. So it would be 2 years, worth of credits in total.
I thought it was just 294 days. That's just kept rolling through the system, and somehow if you prevail now, he will get out at the end of the sentences he's currently serving. Mr. Anderson seems to keep giving the state opportunities to credit him with time, but at the end of the day, it's the 294 days. Is that not right?
Well, Mr. Anderson has argued that the 294 days should have been applied so that it would have adjusted his discharge dates.
Right.
And if his discharge dates had been adjusted in that manner, all of his sentences would have discharged before his arrest in November of 2000. And when he was arrested in November 2000, he began serving the two 1995 sentences of 1 year each. And those should have discharged prior to that arrest. And therefore, he started serving those two sentences first before he began his current sentences that he's serving right now.
So, I mean, and the state has conceded that he is, in fact, still in custody pursuant to the 92 conviction. So
that's
that,
right.
I know, is not on the table. What about fair presentment to the state courts of this issue? I mean, I have no problem conceptualizing as a federal constitutional issue the idea that a state isn't entitled to hold someone in prison 2 years longer than the legitimate sentence. I mean, you serve sentences and then you should be out. But along the way, he really wasn't talking about federal constitutional rights. He was talking about state law. And the way I read Baldwin against Reese, for example, is that the Supreme Court is telling us there should be a fairly high standard of specificity for people.
Well, I think as a first matter, it's important to construe his petition liberally and subject to a less stringent standard because he was pro se in the courts below. And
if he had said something about, you know, my federal rights were violated and he didn't happen to hit on the right citation, maybe the liberal construction rule applies there. But what if he's only talking about how the state computed these various dates? The state didn't really have to give him any credit at all for that 294 days if the state legislature ex ante had specified a longer sentence. And so the fact that they give him the credit too late, if you will, the state courts have said that didn't even violate state law.
Well, to address your first point, I think that Mr. Anderson has made the same core argument to the state courts as he does here today and to the district court. The substance of his claim that the Wisconsin Department of Corrections unfairly apply these credits has remained the same throughout the proceedings.
But how do we know that's a federal claim? I mean, I don't think it's the law of Wisconsin to do things unfairly either. How do you glean from that, especially, as I said, under Baldwin and recent Supreme Court cases, a federal claim?
Well, I think the federal constitutional claim, while not explicitly articulated by Mr. Anderson, a pro se litigant, is implicit in his arguments that he was saying he has been deprived of his liberty and that liberty was taken unfairly from him by the state, by the Department of Corrections.
Okay. All right, so even if he has asserted the claim, which, you know, I understand that that's probably the best you can do in terms of how did it come up, why is this in the end, as Judge Kinney asked, a claim about federal law instead of simply a claim about when and where the state should have applied this initial credit on the 92 sentence?
Well, I think that because first Mr. Anderson has a protected liberty interest in these pre-sentence credits, which are under the statute mandated that any time you spend in custody is to be counted as though you had served that time, including pre-sentencing time, as though you had served that time in the institution to which you are incarcerated. I think because he has a protected liberty interest and the state has acted arbitrarily and unfairly in depriving him of that liberty interest, that rises to the level of a federal constitutional claim in violation of the Due Process Clause.
Do you have some sort of timing idea here? Because I have to say I'm troubled by the fact that the state courts looked at all these computations and concluded that there wasn't a problem. And then we sort of wind up, I guess it's really in the state's brief, with this idea that it's in December of 99 that the sentencing court realizes he should have gotten the credit on the 92 sentence. And somehow that word doesn't sift over to the proper authorities until after he's been arrested. I mean, how much time do they have? Like a week or months?
Well, you're right that Mr. Anderson was arrested in August of 1999. He realized at that time that he did not receive the 294 days that he had spent awaiting sentencing in 1992 when originally sentenced. He petitioned the sentencing court and received the credit in December of 1999. And then he had a parole revocation hearing in April of 2000. So approximately four months later, at which time his credits had still not been applied to his sentence, and his parole was revoked. And then a couple months later, in June of 2000, then the Wisconsin Department of Corrections applies that credit to his sentence.
Right, so he has the parole revoked on June 1st, and he's all of a sudden out again on June 19th or so, right, because they've now applied the 294 days?
That's right. Right. Now, what's crucial here is that for Mr. Anderson's purposes that the credit was not applied before his revocation hearing, so that his discharge dates were not adjusted accordingly.
So the slate just should have been wiped clean. Everybody kind of agrees with that, don't they? The only question is now what are the consequences of these failures?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. If he had received that credit prior to his revocation hearing in April of 2000, two of his three sentences would have discharged by that point. So if he had been properly credited before the April 2000, before his parole was revoked, those two sentences would have discharged.
So there wouldn't have been any parole to revoke.
There would have been the last sentence, the third sentence, to be revoked. But because he served that time, he served enough time from when he was arrested in August of 99 until he was let out in June. That sentence would have then discharged before his arrest in November of 2000.
Mr. Anderson could have made life easier on everyone if he had not had such a habit of being arrested. But there we are.
On the other hand, we might have to all go out and find out his work ourselves if there were people in it. You're into your rebuttal time, right?
Okay, I will reserve the rest of my rebuttal. Thank you.
Muller?
May it please the court. In the first instance, the respondent contends that this court does not have jurisdiction to hear this appeal because Mr. Anderson never received a certificate of appealability allowing him to appeal from the district court's opinion and judgment. The respondent understands that this court relied on Walker versus O'Brien in finding that no COA was needed in order to proceed. But our position is that this case is different than Walker versus O'Brien because Mr. Anderson is not similarly situated to the state prisoner in that case, a prisoner by the name of Finfrock, who was appealing a prison disciplinary board's forfeiture of his good time credits.
Actually, this case on the federal side looks like cases where, although these are becoming few and far between, people are complaining about what the U.S. parole authorities are doing with them. It's an administrative action that he's complaining about. And those are actually not 2255s. They're not conviction or sentence. They are administrative actions. They're done as 2241s. Now, obviously, over in the state side, they're all 2254s.
Mm-hmm. But this is a little bit different because...
It's certainly different. I mean, we can all see the difference from Finfrock, but it's also different from the standard, you know, somebody should have suppressed evidence or somebody should have, you know, there was a Brady problem or whatever. It's not that kind of a case either.
That's right. It doesn't fall within that kind of situation either. But in this case, really, Mr. Anderson is challenging the terminal date of his 1992 sentence.
Which is true in the 2241s, too, when somebody's complaining about the parole board not giving somebody parole when they should have.
Is this just a mistake?
We don't really know what the explanation is for why the order of the circuit court from, I think it was December of 1999, was not actually implemented until June of 2000. The record does not reveal that. Now, obviously, the initial mistake occurred back in 1992 when sentence credit was not accorded in the first place, and apparently Mr. Anderson's attorney was asleep at the switch and
didn't ask. They did correct it. I mean, all of them.
They did correct it, and as a result, when it was implemented, he was immediately released on parole in June of 2000. And at that point, Mr. Anderson did not have any complaint with how that sentence credit was awarded. He was happy because he was back out on parole again. And it wasn't until 2001 where he again got into trouble and had his parole revoked for another time that then he tried to go back and say, when you credited me with this 294 days back in June of 2000, you did it the wrong way, and I never should have been on parole from my 1992 sentence at that point.
But, you know, there are two things about the state's position here that strike me. One of them is that you do concede at this point he is, in fact, still in custody on the 92, as that term of art is used in habeas, on the 92 conviction. And secondly, you have all these kind of hypotheses about what was happening between December 16, 1999 and June 1, 2000. And there is this sort of irreducible fact that his sentences would have been discharged if, instead of taking 6 months, if the sentencing court's action had been implemented by WDOC, let's say on February 1st, his sentences would have been discharged. He would not be in the same position. He would have a lesser period of time to serve. And it's hard for me to minimize that. I understand he gets the 294 days at the time and in the way you describe, but that was not at all an appropriate use of it.
Well, the fact is that he has not had to serve more than the 5 years that he was originally given for his 1992 robbery conviction. I think on page 23 of our brief, we go through the various time periods for which he was in custody related to that 5-year sentence.
Well, I understand that, but you are also had his sentences discharged when they should have been, then his situation would have been different when he was arrested for the offenses for which he's now serving time. I understood you to be agreeing that he would, in fact, have a shorter period of time to serve.
That's correct. I think instead of serving a 37-year aggregate of sentences, his current term would be somewhere 35 years plus some odd months. I don't think that the appellant has ever indicated in his brief exactly what he believes that period to be, but his sentences would have
been shorter.
It would have been shorter, and that's why we conceded that he is in fact in custody for purposes of this challenge to his earlier now expired sentences. But the fact remains, number one, that even if this court finds that he did not need a certificate of appealability, Judge Crabb was still correct in pointing out that this was not framed as a federal constitutional question in the district court. If you read Mr. Anderson's habeas petition, there is no mention made of any federal constitutional amendments, federal case law. Rather, he styled this as being the Division of Hearings and Appeals going outside their jurisdiction when they revoked him. And if you go back to all of the pleadings in the state courts, you look at his two briefs filed in the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, you look at the Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision, the issue was never framed as being an arbitrary deprivation of any kind of liberty interest. It was always framed as being a violation of Wisconsin statutes involving the award of sentence credit or Wisconsin case law regarding how sentence credit is to be determined. So until we got to this court, this is the first time that he has ever said there has been some sort of a due process violation because the state authorities acted arbitrarily in the manner in which they applied this sentence credit. And as an aside, I do find it somewhat ironic that Anderson faults the state for taking 6 months or so to actually implement the award of sentence credit when he sat on his rights from 1992 until 1999 and did not ask for sentence credit until he was subject to having his parole revoked for misconduct. So I think the fact that the state took 6 or 7 months to do that is not all that surprising, considering that there was a 7-year gap in which he never even asked for it. And then even when they applied it back in June of 2000, Mr. Anderson did not have any beef with that. It was not until he got into trouble again in 2001 and had his parole revoked once more that then he tried to go back and say, back in 2000, you misapplied this. So I don't...
We accept your position. In other words, rule in your favor. What happens to Mr. Anderson?
Then his sentences would have commenced sometime in 2002, and I believe his total term was 37 years, as opposed to being calculated as starting in November of 2000, which is when he was arrested for robbery while he was out on parole.
So whatever the result, whether you rule in your favor or your opponent's favor, he's going to serve 30-some years? Is that the idea?
Correct. He's not going anywhere quickly.
If I understand you, are you saying it doesn't make any difference to his ultimate sentence if we rule for you or if we rule for him, or that it does make a difference?
I'm saying that his term in confinement, it does make a difference. And
only have a couple of years. Right?
Correct. Out of 37 years, it will be 35 plus some change. I don't know the exact number there.
Right, but the Supreme Court has held that, at least from the point of view of the person in prison, a couple of years matters.
That's correct, but there's only a due process violation when you are being held beyond the term of your sentence, and he is not being held beyond the term of his sentence because he's never had to serve even the entire 5 years of his 1992 robbery conviction. He wound up serving 4 years and maybe 10 months. I don't know the exact amount, but that's all detailed on pages 23 to 24 of our brief. So for all of these reasons, we ask that this court affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bowler. Ms. Bowler, you have 1 minute.
I would just like to answer any questions, and if you have none, I'll waive my rebuttal time. That's fine.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. Again, Ms. Bowler, you and your firm took this case by appointment, did you not? Thank you again for another fine representation, and thanks to both counsel.